This is Everything is Workable, a podcast where we examine how every experience, every situation, every moment is an opportunity to work with our mind. I'm your host, Caitlin Hatch, creative polymath and dedicated consumer of wisdom. In this season, I talk to other people about their approach to life and practice. Today's episode is with Heather Ordover, former American Lit teacher and current producer-host of the Craft Lit podcast. Curiosity is our main subject. We discuss what it means to cultivate it and the importance of the lifelong practice of learning, as well as how one can help feed and encourage the curiosity of others. We get into how a good question opens up possibilities and often generates more questions, and what it looks like to use curiosity to get woke. Content notification, this episode covers politics, September 11th, and mental illness, and we're both pretty critical of the current Republican president and administration. If you enjoy this episode, please share it. Your support in getting this in front of an ever wider audience is always hugely appreciated. And now, on to my conversation with Heather.
If you want to get political, it can get political. And if you don't want to get political, you don't have to get political.
And now everyone's just really depressed.
Yeah, I don't know. I like depression. It's easier to work with than anxiety. It's the anxiety that's exhausting.
You know, that is the most positive thing I have ever heard anyone say about depression. That is also true.
I've got lots of experience working with both. And
yeah, me too. Yeah.
That's interesting. Maybe that could be how we start off, actually. Lots of experience working with both depression and anxiety in one's own life is very interesting then when we're confronted with something that is, let's call it, a collective experience of trauma.
I like that. Yes. Both anxiety producing and depressing. And you know, it's funny because I was just talking about the word depression days ago with some friends that on my podcast on Craftlit back, what was it, a year and a half ago, 2 years ago? 2 years ago when Robin Williams passed away. Mm. I had worked briefly, like 4 years of my early life in Hollywood, thinking that that's what I wanted to do. And the last job I had was working on Aladdin for Disney. And really? I was the last of three interns, or not interns, production assistants who got to record with Robin. And he was the nicest. I mean, you heard everybody. Nobody has ever said a bad word about him. He is just the nicest man. He was so funny and so smart and so gentle and so obviously depressed. Mm. And I joked about it with a friend that it's kind of like when people in my theater department at UCLA talked about gaydar, that there's also depressed-ar. And I think it's people who are clinically depressed. You can tell when you are talking to somebody else who is one of your people. Uh-huh. And Robin was clearly that. And out in the world, I'd heard so many really casually cruel things that people had said about him and about him taking his own life. And I try not to do things like this normally, but I got on my podcast and I said, look, it is unfortunate that people use the word sad as a synonym for depressed. And I understand why we do that, because when somebody breaks up with you and you are torn apart, you say you're depressed. And it's true. But it's a temporary state of depression. People who live within a constant state of depression, it's a variation of that theme. It's that veil that goes down between you and the world so you can see everything. You can appreciate things. You can laugh at things. You can identify that you love your children. And yet there's this veil between you and any kind of electricity or any kind of liveliness. And that dampening of all of those things is not being sad. It's a very, very different thing. When something like this happens, a trauma that is commonly experienced by many people, whether it's what we just went through, whether it's 9/11, or, you know, your house burnt down and everyone in your family is affected, of course you're sad, but there is this extra layer, a recognition, like you said before, that you've crossed a barrier. And things get lost and feelings get fractured and fragmented, and it makes it take a while, I think, for thoughtful people to kind of put things back together again and figure out, well, how are we going to construct ourselves moving forward in a way that's effective and that fits within the world the way we want it to be.
Yeah. And I think also, how do you do whatever you need to do to be an agent for change, understanding mm-hmm. you're a component part of something bigger than yourself, but at the same time, make time for self-care.
Boy, yes, indeed. That's the crux of it, isn't it? It's the not losing touch with what you know to be good and right, and finding that the new pathway that allows you to honor that and still recognize that things shifted.
That makes me think of a parable I heard recently. It's a story of a forest fire. It's raging along, and there's this little hummingbird, and the hummingbird is flying down to a lake and taking up little mouthfuls of water and then flying back and dumping it on the fire. And it keeps doing this back and forth, and there's all the other animals of the forest who are standing by the side of the riverbank watching this hummingbird, and they're all laughing at it and like, what are you doing? Why are you even bothering? And the hummingbird just says, well, at least I'm doing everything I can do.
Yeah. I find that creative people are the people who often are left feeling like Chicken Little. Is it mm-hmm. Chicken Little? Yeah. It's so easy to sit on the sidelines and laugh. And it's so not a choice for the hummingbirds to keep trying.
This is an interesting one that I've been working with as a creative person, where I've been thinking about actually valuing the contributions that I make as being enough.
Yeah.
And really believing it.
Yeah.
Like, it is enough that I put this podcast together. It is enough that I just wrote a blog post.
It is. And you do. It's true. You do have to kind of say, okay, well, it's the best I can do with what I've got right now. And if I can do more eventually, then I'll do more.
Yeah. Don't know if you want to talk any about your experience of actually being in New York when 9/11 happened, but also maybe just talking a bit about that, and then how your experience of living through that is applying to the action you're taking right now.
That's a really interesting question. It even goes back further, and I don't know where it comes from. I suppose, well, it might come from the fact that on both sides of my family, there were pioneers. And as my husband says, humorously, but not inaccurately, there is probably something wrong with people who in a covered wagon get to the Rockies and look up and say, yeah, let's keep going. That's just a dividing line between people who are smart and people who are a little nuts. But that may also have something to do with my attitude that anytime something traumatic or personally hurtful in a big sense, not like, oh, somebody said something mean to me, but generally larger than that.
Human rights being threatened sense.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And personal safety being threatened, because that was 9/11. And then I had a whole other experience similar to that when I was at university, that my initial reactions are like everybody's, you know, there's the kind of shock and dismay and depression and sadness and all of that stuff. But eventually it works its way through to, I don't want anybody else to have to go through this, whatever it is. And so my first experience with that was when I was 18 and a half, and I helped the University of California system rewrite their protocols for date and acquaintance rape that happened on campus, particularly in their dormitories. There would have been no protocol before that, and that was 1986.
Wow.
And it was really, really important to me that some benefit to everyone came out of it, because I knew I wasn't going to win. And so somebody else had to. So that kind of colored a lot of my adult life to date, and included also the work that I decided to do, that I left Hollywood and started teaching high school, because again, I could feel more comfortable in a world where I had some opportunity to help young people, not children. I taught mostly juniors and sophomores and juniors in high school, but if I could see them improving, if I could see them being okay, being happy, being confident that they could go out and affect whatever change they wanted to affect in the world, whether that was going out and starting their own business or going to university, whatever it was, I knew that I would be able to sleep better at night. And that was definitely true. And I learned a lot from listening to my students as well. And then when I moved to New York City and I taught in the city, my cohort of kids changed dramatically. I'd taught in an almost entirely white collar, non-college educated, but making a lot of money environment in Southern California. And it was toxic in lots and lots of ways. There was no curiosity. There was zero. Mm-hmm. And the kids who were curious were considered the freaks. And of course, those were the kids who I had the most fun with. But but then going to New York City, the cohort changed entirely. They were all city kids. Some of them traveled an hour and a half on the subways to get to our school down by the World Trade Center site. And they wanted an education. They wanted to go to college. They wanted to be, if not the first generation of their family to go to college, they were the second. They were motivated. They were smart. They were funny. And they really wanted what kids at prep schools were getting. So I walked in, you know, from Southern California going, okay, so like, we're going to write a constitution for like our classroom. And like, everybody's going to participate because it's really important for you to have, you know, like buy-in. And the kids just were like looking at me kind of going blink, blink, blink. And finally, one of the boys raised his hands and said, Miss, are we going to read any Shakespeare this year? And I stopped and I said, well, it's American lit, so no, but the way you're saying that makes me think you read some last year. And they all started to say, oh yeah, we read Taming of the Shrew, we read Macbeth, we read Othello. And I thought, wow, I'm not in Southern California anymore. This is different. And I started asking them questions and saying, what is it you were looking for this year? And it became very clear they were looking for college prep. And I said, I'm going to go home this weekend and rewrite the curriculum. And I'm going to thwack y'all on the head come Monday morning, and you're going to have to deal with it. And they said, okay. And I've never seen anything like it. These kids worked their butts off in ways that I certainly never did when I was in school. They got a 100% better education than I'd ever had in high school.
And this is beautiful, because what you're sharing there is a combination of mutual curiosity and flexibility. To me, that is what it is to be a teacher, is to encourage curiosity, and also as a teacher, to be curious. Would you say that this is something that you've always naturally had, or is it something that you developed over time?
My parents were very young when they had me, and they were in college themselves. And as a consequence, I think what happened was I would ask a question like any, you know, three-year-old would. But the difference was, instead of my parents being exhausted and miserable and trapped in a job that they hated, they were at school themselves and had probably just recently learned the answer to whatever it was that I was asking. So I remember vividly, I was 5 years old, and my dad, he either just started graduate school or he was just about to graduate from his undergrad. And I asked him why it rained. And he said, that's an excellent question. Come with me. And so we went into the kitchen and we got out two little margarine tubs and took a grease pencil and drew a line in each of them at the same height and poured water in. And one of them we put the plastic top on to seal it. And the other one we took cheesecloth and we cut a piece of cheesecloth and rubber banded that onto the top. And we took those outside and we sat them on the picnic table out back. And he said, okay. And I said, but Dad, why does it rain? And he said, well, tomorrow we're going to come back and you'll see. I said, okay. So the next day we went out at the same time of day and he had me look at the level of water in the one with the cheesecloth and it was gone. And then we carefully opened the lid on the other one and the water was still there. Mm-hmm. And he said, so what do you think happened? I actually don't remember if I figured it out myself or not. I kind of doubt it. But the idea that my question could be answered with other questions clearly had an effect on me, because that has stuck with me for a really long time now. And that was definitely how my whole world was framed as a kid, that questions were never ignored. They were never laughed at. They were never passed off. And often the response included more questions.
Yeah, that's absolutely beautiful. There's I don't know if you've ever seen it, there's a comic that goes around online every once in a while, and it's these two monsters in a park. And one of them has a shoebox, and the other monster, it's like one of them's a young monster with this little shoebox, and the other one's this older monster. He's like, what do you got? what's that in your shoebox? And he's like, well, it's my collection. He's like, what's your collection? He says, it's questions. He says, you collect questions. There's no value in questions. And this old monster is like, oh, answers are where it's at. And it's just this really beautiful exchange where at the very end, this older monster asks this roaring question about the value of collecting questions and holding on to questions, and then storms off, and the young one opens up the box and says, did you hear that one? I've got a new friend for you.
That's so awesome.
It is. And also what I love about it is, like, part of the narrative is saying having an answer is the death of a question and therefore the death of curiosity.
Yes.
It's so powerful when you can learn to understand what it is to have a response or an understanding of something without feeling like you have to know it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that that's probably part of what encouraged me to keep going. And also, I know that there's a real problem in education, especially with math and science education, where girls right around middle school and high school start to pull back and not ask questions. And I was the annoying one in class who never stopped. And partly I think it was because I knew just enough to know what I didn't know and what I wanted to know more about, except in my math classes. And so in math class, I was absolutely silent, but it wasn't because I wasn't curious. It was because I didn't know how to ask the question because I didn't know what it was that I was missing. And it took me a long time to figure out that that's what the problem was, and that somewhere along the line, something fundamental had been lost. And in looking back, I think actually what was lost was the why. Mm-hmm. Not why do we have to take math? That's the wrong why. The why is, well, wait a minute, but why do numbers behave that way? And why do we need to balance the equation? I think that those are always the interesting questions. Well, why does that happen? Why do people do this? Why do we feel this way? Or why do we feel compelled? Why do some of us feel compelled to help or build or create and others feel compelled to break?
Yeah, or protect.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a beautiful metaphor, really, isn't it? Like, looking mm-hmm. at the why of math. And I just want to come back. You said you didn't know what you didn't know, so you didn't know how to ask questions. And that is such an interesting point for me, because it's something that I use to remind myself to keep my heart open to people who I might otherwise choose to hate them. And I'm like, I'm not going to let me hate you, because you do not know what you do not know.
Mm-hmm.
And there's sort of two parts to that. There is, on the one hand, how do you inspire curiosity in people to try to look at what they do not know? But then also understanding that you're not responsible for other people changing their minds. You can't do that. It's an interesting one. Like, I same thing. I grew up in a household. My dad is such a scientist. And my mom, despite what she likes to say, is such an artist. And and my dad is also an artist. There's another myth that gets taught, is that science and art don't mix. I'm like, are you kidding? Have you not looked at M.C. Escher?
Right? Hello? Yeah. I think that's one of the biggest misconceptions ever.
Yeah. So being exposed to all of that, it's not until, and so speaking to that, not knowing what you don't know, right? When you're raised to know that curiosity is valuable, you don't know that other people aren't raised that way. So it's one of those things, like, I bring back on myself where I'm like, I'm frustrated with them for not knowing what they don't know because I don't know what I don't know about their experience.
Yeah. Boy, that is so key. And I love that we have a very interesting connected background with the parental unit makeup, because mine are similar. But I also know that what you're talking about, as I taught longer, my last 2 years of teaching, I fundamentally changed part of my teaching practice. And it was that all of a sudden, actually it was right before 9/11, I realized that kids were getting graded in English classes for not being perfect writers. And I thought, well, that's kind of wrong, because here we're always talking about, you know, Thomas Edison made so many mistakes before he ever got a light bulb that worked. And you're really trying to gung-ho that idea with students, but then you're averaging their grades and they will always be damaged by the thing they didn't know or the thing they didn't know how to do perfectly. Mm-hmm. And why are we expecting them to come in knowing how to do anything? That's not the point. And so I changed how I graded, and I knew that I had to have some kind of a cutoff. So I said, okay, anyone who hands their essay in on time, and this is an essay that we'd worked on together in class. They'd had plenty of time to draft it. No one had been left in the lurch. If you hand it in on time, your final draft, you have all the way up until the end of the semester to make it perfect. And I will grade or respond to any draft you hand in that has been an honest attempt to make it better, not just fixing typos, but really looking at it structurally, looking at the whole thing, looking at your arguments and trying to improve it. And therefore, if you don't have an A by the end of the semester, it's your own damn fault. And I had teachers get really, really angry with me about that. For one thing, they said, you know, kids are going to take advantage of that. Well, no, they didn't ever.
How could they take advantage of it? It's so weird. I mean, it's sort of like you're giving them an equation and telling them how to figure out how to polish your equation.
Yeah. Yeah. Make it beautiful. And I'm here to help you.
Yeah.
And if you don't take advantage of that, then that's fine. But then that's the grade you earned. And it was, I think that was part of it too, was that kids would always say, you gave me a B. You gave me, I didn't give you anything. You have rubrics, you know how you're going to be graded, you know what's expected of you, and I'm always here to help. And I think that last bit's really crucial. But there's a huge discussion within the world of academics about whether that's a good idea or not.
I like that shift, though, in the thought process, right? About you gave it to me, because that's such a common thing for people to do is things happen to me. I don't make them happen. I don't have control over. I don't have free agency. And I'm like, yes, you do.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, you do. And it can very, very easily feel like that's not true when things feel dangerous and crazy.
Yeah.
When you're in school, it feels like the adults have some secret key. And they're the ones who hold all the power over you. And right now, there are plenty of people in the United States who feel the same way over their livelihood, over their ability to have a decent life. And I think it's the curiosity, but also the creativity to sit back and say, okay, well, where's the power? Where is the power? And who's wielding it? Because it starts to feel very Zaphod Beeblebrox-like that you know, the people who are elected are wielding our attention away from where the power is being held.
Yeah.
And so then it becomes a completely different kind of question and a different kind of search for the point at which you can affect the most change to benefit the most people most of the time.
Most of the
and
time.
And that's a little bit less depressing to look at.
It is. And that's where is one of those things that I talk about as often as I can, where I say, like, we cannot look at a complex issue as having a singular reason, right?
Yeah. Like, yeah,
nothing came out of a singularity ever, and nothing can be solved by changing just one thing. But knowing that, it's sort of like, how can I own what I can change about how I think, about what I do and say in the world? I liked when you said, no one else should have to go through this.
Mm-hmm.
From my point of view as a Buddhist, there's actually a specific meditation practice you can do called Tonglen that uses that. I don't know if you're familiar with
it. You wrote about that on your blog, didn't you?
Yes, I did. So Tonglen is basically going, wow, I feel really anxious right now, or I feel really depressed right now. And since I'm feeling this anyway, may I breathe this in so no one else has to feel it? And may I give out whatever I feel the antidote is to that. And on the surface of it, for people who don't understand a lot about any kind of spiritual practice, it can seem a bit woo and like, oh, what, you're like doing energy shifting and whatever. And I'm like, no, it's changing your mind. It's changing the way you think about it, because what it's doing is it's breaking down your resistance to feeling crap so that you can genuinely relate to how you feel. And when you relate to how you feel within yourself, you start to understand how other people feel, because we are pretty much the same. When it comes to the emotive level of things, like, yes, there's a spectrum. We've got some different experiences. Unpopular opinion, don't think that sociopaths are inhuman. I think that they're just on a different spectrum on being able to relate to people. But there are examples of sociopaths who do not kill people. There are lots of them, actually. And they try and they learn and they adapt and they adjust. And I like to use the example of anyone who's on the autism spectrum. And there's a beautiful, I can't remember the exact quote, but Temple Grandin makes the remark.
I love her.
She's fabulous. She makes the remark that she finds it incredibly ironic that, and she uses the term normal people, which I find very weird. Because I'm like, well, I wouldn't call us normal. I don't know that there is a normal. But she says, you know, normal people get afraid of people who are on the autism spectrum because they see us as not being able to have empathy, which I find ironic.
Because they're being absolutely non-empathetic when they say that.
Exactly.
Yes. Oh, my good God. Yes. Oh, she's so right.
So I think that's where, and it's coming back and going, no one should have to go through this, regardless of your experience of the world, regardless of your embodiment. No one should have to feel that kind of trauma or that kind of pain, and saying like, yeah, what can I do to be of the greatest benefit or to cause the least amount of harm?
Well, and I think that that's also, you know, when you talk about that particular Buddhist practice, that makes me remember what some Christian friends of mine have said about prayer. When there's any, well, I think it's when there's any kind of level of focus where you as a human are focusing on something outside of yourself and recognizing that there is an outside of yourself to care about, that whole process is a really healing process, and it does make you feel better. Whether it's Christian prayer or meditation or any spiritual practice, that there is something, or even giving birth and having a child, and all of a sudden realizing, as many of us have talked about, when you're in the hospital and somebody puts this thing into your arms that you are in no way capable of caring for at that exact moment, there's this shock of, oh crap, this thing is going to be dependent on me forever.
Yeah.
And there's a level of awe, a complete mental shift and a widening of your world has happened. And it's a very similar state to some of the benefits that I've certainly read about and seen and experienced in on some level to meditation and prayer. But it's also the kind of thing I think that happens for curious people, and especially creatively curious people, when you find someone who you click with and you talk about things outside yourself. There's that kind of transcendent, I think probably the first level is, oh, I'm not alone, which is always a nice thing to feel.
Yeah.
And then the larger and wider, oh, and there's hope. It's such a calming state to be in, I think, along with what you were saying. You know, I'm going to breathe the anxiety in so that nobody else has to have it hanging around them. It's the same, maybe by talking to these people and knowing that these people are out there, I can then turn around and do something better for someone else, whether it's, you know, smiling at a stranger on the street and making their day. I remember walking by a guy. I was in a miserable state of mind in New York. It was probably after 9/11, actually. And God only knows what my face looked like. And there's this really nice older African-American man on the street who said, chin up. And I looked at him and I probably shot daggers with my eyes. I was so not in the mood to be cheered up at that point.
Yeah.
But when I turned to look at him, he had this smile on his face that was just gently mocking. It's like, girl, nothing could be so bad that you should be doing that to your face right now. It's, you know, resting bitch face. And so he had this smile that was both mocking, but also incredibly gentle. And and hopeful. And I stopped and I said, thank you. And I must have smiled at him because he said, that's my girl. And he turned and he went on his way. And for the rest of the day, I was just floating on a cloud because this guy had smiled at me and been kind and funny and also made fun of me, kind of, because I deserved it. Because nothing really probably was as bad as what my face looked like at that point.
It's kind of like he popped you out of your bubble of...
Yeah.
And this is a mantra I've got right now is, it's not about you. Like, it's not about me.
Yeah.
It's not all about me. And yes. That, I think that's such an interesting exchange because, like, there's all this conversation, obviously, around women being told to smile and a lot of misunderstanding about what that means and context, right? Like, you're sharing context. He didn't tell you to be beautiful. He didn't tell you that you would be prettier. He said chin up.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, that's such a statement of lift your head up. He's not telling you to smile. He's just like saying, look around, get out of your small little bubble.
Yeah. And the chin up too, I think is there's the other side of that, especially when you're talking to a woman, that the chin up is not something you would say to a weak person. You know, there was none of the patting on the head. Oh, honey.
Yeah.
Or sweetie. It's okay. It's all going to be fine. No, it's chin up.
Yeah.
You can do it.
It's an exchange of equals. He's like, I acknowledge that you feel like crap, but remember there's a big wide world around you. And especially, I'm going to say, especially coming from a Black man.
It was one of the things that I really, really loved about living in New York was we were all on top of each other all the time. You can't stay in a bubble and ride the subway. You just can't.
Well, I'm going to have to say living in London, there's a lot of English people who would argue with you on that one, but it's cultural differences.
No, and actually now that you say that, I imagine it also had something to do with which subway line I lived on.
Yeah.
Because I was in Brooklyn, but that is definitely true. If I had been riding down from the Upper East Side, it probably would have been a little different heading down towards Wall Street.
As another thing that's worth reflecting on in our experience in our communities and who we connect with, because it's very easy to become isolated. And I appreciate how much exposure has popped my bubbles repeatedly and how good that is.
Oh, yeah. No, I have two stories, one that's podcast related and one that was with my sister of moments where my bubble was popped in such marvelous and surprising ways, where I went down to visit my sister when she was in the Dominican Republic working on her PhD. And I'm 5'8". I'm taller than a lot of Dominican men. So I stand out like a sore thumb. Plus, I used to joke with my students that I'm so pasty white. I'm not white. I'm translucent. It's like you can see my veins. And so they made fun of me, which I thought was also great. But I got down to the DR and my sister and I had to go to some clubs where musicians who she was following were playing. And we went to these small clubs. And then the last place we went to was a dance hall. And it was like a football field long. It was huge, with a huge, tall roof. It was beautiful. And everybody's out on the dance floor, having a great time. Music's loud. And then off to the sides of the dance floor were all of the tables, and everybody who wasn't dancing is sitting down, and they're watching my sister, who's 5'3" and also pasty white. They're watching both of us walk all the way down the side to the back where the bar is, because we had to go see the empresario who was working there.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all pointing and whispering. And I thought, oh yeah, because here, pasty white girl standing out like a sore thumb. Sure. I get it. It's okay. And we get back to the back and the impresario is talking really, really fast, and I can't follow the conversation. I don't speak a lot of Spanish, but I can understand it pretty well. And my sister kept nodding and smiling, and she introduced us. And then he asked her a question, and she smiled and said, okay. And he said, okay, the next one. And I got that much. And he walked away, and I said, what's going on? And she said, oh, he's just going to have me, he's just going to introduce me in a minute. And I thought, well, that's a little odd, but okay. He called her up on stage to play a set with the band because she'd been on TV the week before as the person who was there to save and record the history of Merengue Típico, which was getting lost. So people weren't pointing, certainly not at me, but they were pointing and talking about my sister.
Right.
Because she'd been on television and they all knew her name and how important she was to music that was going to get lost otherwise. And I thought, oh, well, duh. And what a moron you were. That was really stupid. And how awesome it was that I was that lame. I loved that moment. But the other one that happened was with the podcast we were doing a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, we were doing Her Land. That's a 1914 feminist satiric take kind of on the Shangri-La story.
Okay.
And I remembered it as being very funny in 1987. It's a little less funny now. And I hadn't really thought that one through very clearly. And people were having very, very complicated reactions to the story. And I was getting a lot of, not backlash, but, and not necessarily negative feedback, but unhappy with being taxed in this way feedback. But then I went, we have a lot of people who listen to the podcast are knitters. And there's a knitting website called Ravelry that's like a Facebook for knitters where
I
you can share.
I know about Ravelry.
Like, oh, are you a knitter too, or crocheter?
I tried because my psychologist was like, this is great for mindfulness practice. And it was fun, but I abandoned it.
Yeah, I was going to say there's a learning curve before you get to the mindfulness part. I have a whole talk that I do on mindfulness and knitting, but it's Ravelry is interesting, and we have a craftlit group for the podcast, and you know there's thousands of people in there, and I was scrolling through and watching the thread, the discussion about the book, and someone made a kind of an offhand remark about how those people, which is always loaded, how those people think about casually think about or casually treat things like abortion. And there's this marked silence. You can watch the time codes on the conversation. So that's come screeching to a halt. And it's like, wait, 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 wait. And then another listener in Berkeley, who I've known for years, several years now because of the podcast, she came on and said, huh, it's interesting that you say that. Did you have a negative experience with someone who actually had an abortion? Wait, 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 wait. Well, no, but I know that that's something that those people say. Wait, 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 wait. Huh, that's pretty interesting because I have a feeling that some of my friends fall into the category of those people. And I actually have never heard them say anything like that. What I have heard them say is this, that, and the other thing. Wait, 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 wait. Really? But that's just like what my friends say. And I thought, okay, so I have now managed to pull together the one place on the internet where a conversation can happen without anger or rancor or screaming matches. But because of that, where two people who probably couldn't have had that conversation in real life are able to hear each other. And I always pull it back to the two things that the people who listen to the podcast are lovers of classic literature, either because they know they should love it and didn't before, because I have a lot of science majors who are like, well, everybody's always making these jokes about Jane Eyre and Rochester, and I thought I probably should figure out what the hell they're all talking about. Or it's people who love these books, and it's another opportunity to engage with them in a way that they can do while they're still, you know, vacuuming and doing dishes and knitting. And then the other cross-section is that the people who I've met who are listeners are creators, whether it's that they're creating knitted things for their family or science experiments where they're having to think through a problem creatively and come up with a way to test their theory. There's a cross-section of people, I think, who are in those two categories where those two categories intersect. And they are just really interesting, wonderful people. And I do not find myself in agreement with them ever on all things, but I always know I can listen to them and learn how that other side is thinking in a way that I wouldn't be able to do just by watching TV or listening to the radio or even reading stuff on the internet.
Yeah, no, I'm just not doing that right now.
Yeah, me either. Me either. It's not healthy, and it's not helpful, and it's not meant to be healthy or helpful right now.
Yeah.
There's so much screaming going on. And of course, I'm biased, but I don't remember in the last two elections, the previous two elections, I don't remember the winners being so smug. But I have a feeling that the winners in those last two elections were perceived as being smug. And that's probably just as bad.
Yeah. And then again, it brings it back on yourself. You're like, how much am I perceiving smugness here? And how much am I actually just seeing a shift in my thought that I had when I was listening to a talk the other day was, there's a statement that this was a vote made out of hate. And I was like, how different is it in my brain when I say this is a vote made out of fear?
Yeah, that's exactly the word I was going towards. Yep.
And so that's it, is sort of like, how do you work with people's fear? And I guess that's it, right? Is how do you acknowledge that someone's afraid when they're making a statement that you're taking as aggressive and a personal attack?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then go, actually, my part in this is that I am just as easily going to be triggered to anger, and I'm going to choose to not be the person who takes that step. I'm going to be the one who chooses to. There's actually a phrase by Arlie Hochschild that I really like, which is, I'm going to disarm my alarm system so that I can talk to you.
I like that. And isn't that the key too, is that the on some very fundamental level, and this isn't a good or bad value judgment, it's a on some fundamental level, the things that we aren't afraid of, things like curiosity and questions, the unknown or the unknowability of things, these are things that don't make us freak out. Those are exactly the things that terrify other people. And so does that mean that part of our responsibility is to make the unknown feel less fearsome, or just to put a face to an attitude or a point of view that allows for that state of being? I find Neil deGrasse Tyson to be the most charming, hilarious, wonderful man on the planet. But I also understand that to some people, his embracing of and comfort level with changing Pluto's status is really, really uncomfortable, because how can you decide something isn't a planet? It hasn't moved or changed. Why are you telling me that it's not?
Yeah.
And that I'm fine with it. I don't really have a personal opinion about Pluto, but although there are plenty of people who do.
It's a good example of recognizing how fundamentalist we can become about anything. And thinking, yes, if people can be that fundamentalist about the definition of a moon rock, of a space rock that's just like out there that none of us will ever set foot on, then consider the level of awareness that needs to be taken in having open conversation about anything. Knowing you're never going to find anyone who agrees with you 100% on everything. But by and large, in my experience, everyone I meet just wants to be safe. They want to feel content and they want to be happy. They just want their lives to be easy. And knowing that, like, if I go in knowing everyone just wants their life to be easy, you know, maybe happy is not the right word, because I know people get weird about that one. So I'm like, people just want to have an easy life.
Yeah.
And I want to have an easy life. So how can we have a conversation when we're both coming to it from that place? Or at the very least, I'm coming to it from that place.
One of the places where I constantly stumble and have yet to find an answer that I'm settled with is, how do I have a conversation when we can't agree on the facts? When everything becomes an opinion. I just had this conversation with a parent here in our town, and we're in a fairly left-leaning town for the most part-ish, but nobody leaning left spoke out. Everybody leaning right got very loud in town. And so it felt like we were no longer in the town we thought we were in. And as a consequence, her son was coming home saying things that they fundamentally don't agree with. They're Quaker.
Right. Wow.
There was nothing on the right the on the screaming right, not the old school conservative right, but nothing on the screaming right that jibed with their values at all. And yet her son was coming home going, well, no, this is okay. And she said, I just don't know what to do about that, because, you know, you can go on the internet and you can find websites that say everything. And I said, right, but there are ways to be able to tell if the website is valid or based in fact or anything other than opinion. There is a difference between opinion and fact. Mm-hmm. And when your kid comes home and you say the sky is blue, and they say, well, that's your opinion, you go, okay, well, let's actually talk about fact and opinion for a moment, and let's actually take it out of there entirely and go back to saying, all right, well, what did I mean when I said the sky was blue? Let's talk about refraction and light and how this stuff works. And then you can decide if what you really mean is it's your opinion to call the sky blue because you're basing that on a scientific theory that includes spectrum analysis and light refraction. Or if you're thinking, actually, that's not what I would call blue, it's a little gray today. Because you, at some point, you have to start defining terms. Because like you said, I think even with words like happy, people are coming to the table with a lot of extra loading on their words. Mm-hmm. And I'm finding that if I can pull people back and saying, okay, well, you're going to have to educate me, because I'm not sure that I understand exactly what it is that you're saying. And often they answer their own issue by doing that. And then my work is done. I don't have to do anything.
Yeah. Well, and it's asking questions like, what's your source of information? Or mm-hmm. what is your working definition of that word? And that's been something mm-hmm. that I've found hugely beneficial. I'm like, I communicate much better when I understand that when I... Because people are like, oh, well, everyone knows what that means. I'm like, no.
Uh-uh.
They don't. Nope. We all have our different definitions. And I know that my definition of happiness is not what most people mean when they say happiness. I know that.
Uh-huh.
Which is why I am careful about using it unless I can define how I'm qualifying it.
It's so smart of you to even notice that.
Yeah. Well, you know, and it's taken time. And I guess that's the other thing is having that awareness and patience, right? I was fortunate to be raised in a household where curiosity was instilled in me, but I was still a complete basket case by the time that I was 23 and mm-hmm. Had crippling anxiety. And then it's taken mm-hmm. like the last 8 years of practice and self-reflection to get to a point of relative sanity and clarity, but I still have a long way to go.
Wow. It only took you 8 years to get there? Dude. I'm just going to bow down in front of you because I'm not worthy.
I'm really disciplined.
That's good, because I'm not. So then I feel better now. Okay, that's good.
And yeah. I get, and like, that's the thing, right? Like, we each have our strengths that we bring to it, and we each have our own things. And it's valuing that everyone's coming from a different perspective. Yeah. And that perspective is totally valid because that's their experience, right?
Yeah. It's so true. And it's also the rhythm thing. My first real experience with it, I think, was after 9/11. The teachers at our school, we all healed at different rates.
Yeah.
And I went down the rabbit hole real fast. I'd already been down the PTSD route before, and I knew more or less how it went. This was much, much worse. My husband was worried about me. I was worried about me. It was not good. And a lot of it was because my instinct after I was okay, after I knew my students were okay, after the towers came down, my instinct was to go back because I needed to do something to help. And I couldn't do anything to help. And then people came on and said, you know, just go shopping. And well, that doesn't help. I want to plant a victory garden. I want to feed the homeless. I want to donate blood like so many people did. You know, I want to do something. And being told that there's nothing to do is very incapacitating and not helpful. And I think that that actually contributed more to my going down a rabbit hole. But then the teachers at school, some of them were quite scornful of the fact that I went down the rabbit hole so fast. What I didn't know at the time, and I learned later, was that they were self-medicating at night, smoking or drinking, which I wasn't doing at the time. And so when we went back to school the next September, 4 or 5 days before the anniversary, they were not just down a rabbit hole. They were not okay at all. And I was actually pretty good. I know there was a lot of talk on the interwebs on the 10-year anniversary, and there was a lot of just get over it. And I thought, you know, the kind of grief that you go through when your home turf is attacked like that is so multi-layered. It's not like your grandfather died. It's so weird. Mm-hmm. And it only makes me think that people who are living in war zones where that's constantly happening, I don't have any way to process what that would do to a human. I can't imagine that it's good. Hmm. But the kind of psychic damage that has to be happening. I just keep thinking about people in Syria and Iraq and Afghanistan. If I think about it too hard, I'll just start crying because I've had such a small taste of it and it was so horrible that I have to keep reminding myself, yeah, but that's why other people don't respond the way that you're responding. They didn't have to deal with any of that. It's so easy on the outside to look and go, well, you know, you survived. What's the problem? And it's one of those lessons that I wish there was an easier way to learn it than to have to go through it. But I've started to kind of think that maybe you just have to have something horrible happen. And then you can start to see, oh, it's a process.
I reckon. Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I am so excited to have had a chance to meet you, and you've made me feel a whole lot better about the world.
Oh, I'm glad. See, you know what I realized a few weeks ago, I realized that I can tick off my to-do list endlessly and get loads of stuff done. But if there's nothing on there that benefits someone else, it doesn't amount to anything. And so at the end of the day, if I'm like, oh, I wasted my day, I look back and be like, that's because I only did things for myself. So
wow,
having
that
one person say to me, you made my day, or you made me feel better about the world, I'm like, good, excellent.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense. I'm going to go look at my to-do lists that made me really depressed. And now I have a feeling I'll be able to identify what was wrong with them.
There you go. See?
Yep.
Just paying that forward. From one awesome. Incredibly busy person to another.
It's true.
Thank you so much for listening. Visit craftlit.com, that's craftlit.com, to listen to Heather's podcast, which is a collection of classic literature readings and discussions to be enjoyed while knitting, cooking, painting, or simply for their own sake as the focus of your attention. To find out more about what I do, visit kaylinschatch.com, where you can read my blog, sign up to get my monthly wrap-up email, and leave a tip to help support the show and other things that I do. Thank you as well to Dexter Britton for composing the fantastic music accompanying this and the previous two seasons of Everything is Workable.